I was secretly hoping that this guy, I don't know if you want to call this my own ego, but I was secretly hoping this guy would stick around. Because the first day I heard him share a little bit of the story, I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy's just like me. And except for the fact I've got him by about 15 years. But I don't want to swell his head up too much, but he's a really good guy, and I'm honored to be his friend. And you came here to hear him and not me, so without further ado, here's Art.
A lot of people.
My name's Hart, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to try and make it through this thing. I want to take a second just to recognize some people. In my first year, I had to attend three funerals, Lance B., Rob B., and Kevin M., and I had very few friends at that time. The reason I say that is that if you're sitting in this room, it doesn't matter if you're homeless or if you're dreaming or if you live in the hills, you got a second chance today, and if you lived like I lived, it's probably a chance you didn't deserve. Lance and I used to sit out on that picnic table at Saturday night meetings and say, you know, one day they'll ask us to speak, you know, one day we'll make it. Lance passed away this January, and I'm proud that I get to be up here and to share my story with you guys. So I hope that I will do their memories honor tonight. I was born in Sarasota in 1982. My sobriety date, by the way, is June 16th, 2010, so Marty wasted no time in getting me up here. I've also been told not to pound on the podium, so. Marty wasted no time getting me up here right after I got my 1 year. But I was born in Sarasota, and my parents were middle class. We weren't poor, but we weren't rich. In my first 2 weeks, I heard somebody say that they felt like they were born uncomfortable, and I identified with that because I feel like the first 13 years of my life, I was completely inadequate in my own skin. I felt like I was not good enough, that I was not worthy of personal friendships, that nobody liked me, and I was completely uncomfortable and miserable most of the time, and it reflected in my relationships with my friends and my family and my production at school and things like that. And when I was 12 years old, I'd had a couple of drinks, but I got drunk when I was 12 years old for the first time. I broke into my mom's liquor cabinet, and I think I had three friends over, and we just got completely hammered. I mean, it was tequila and bourbon, I believe. And, I was 12 years old, and I really had no experience with alcohol prior to that. You know, I'd sipped off my dad's beer can a couple of times, but just completely got wasted, threw up all over the place. My mom caught us, they were supposed to spend the night, threw everybody out, just complete debacle. But I remember feeling that night, after, you know, like two shots, that I didn't hate the way I felt anymore. And from that point on, alcohol and other things, my story does contain other things, but I'm going to limit that, was a way that I used to not feel so terrible about myself. And that continued. I got into a lot of trouble growing up. I ripped my family off, all that good stuff. Got sent to my first juvenile detention center at 14 and did 9 months there. Got out, you know, stayed clean for a little, like I think maybe 2 weeks, and was just right back at it. I think I stayed out for 8 months, and then I was right back in for another 6 months. I ended up doing that. I did that twice, not to mention numerous stints at mental health clinics, psychiatrist's office, and things like that. And, you know, every time I got out, I said, I don't want to live like that anymore. And every time I got out, I felt so horrible about who I was and the things that I had done that the only recourse that I felt I had was to start drinking again. So I went to my last program when I was about, I got in when I was 17, got out when I was 18, and after all the things that I had done to my mom, who I'm very grateful is here tonight, she didn't want me to come back and live with her after all the times that I had screwed up. So she asked that I go live with my dad, who's my relationship with had been strenuous at best, and I did, and I actually, I think I put together 3 months without a drink. when I got out of that program. And I got my GED while I was there, so, you know, things were kind of going okay. I met a girl, and everything was going good, validated some of my self-worth, and pretty soon I started feeling crappy about myself again. And I started drinking. The drinking really got bad for me when I got to college. You know, growing up, it was smoking pot and, you know, throwing keg parties when the parents weren't there, sometimes when they were there. It really got out of control with amongst other things when I got to college. I got my GED when I was in the program as a juvenile, and when I came out, I went to community college and I did well, and I majored in all kinds of things, and I was president of the film club and all these accolades and had all these wonderful things going for me. Good job, nice car, place to live. Still felt completely terrible, and 3 months out, I started, you know, right back at the bottle, and eventually I made it into college. I got accepted to UCF. I moved up here, and I was holding it together. That's all I was doing, was just, you know, using enough to make it to class, and when I would get out of class, all bets were off. And I don't deal well with new situations, which some of you may be surprised, because coming in here I was pretty friendly and easy to get to know, but I wasn't always like this at all. I social anxiety was a huge problem for me. And coming to, you know, Orlando, where I didn't know anybody, and I was basically coming up here to go to school because I wanted to be a film student and I wanted to make movies, I didn't know how to deal with anything, so I figured, well, I'll just be the guy who parties. And that's what I did. I was the guy who always knew where everything was. And when I got up here, I had experimented with the drug selling game a little bit. That's part of what my my charges stem from as a juvenile. But it got out of control in Orlando because I thought that's what the cool thing to do was. So I thought that if, you know, I knew where the party was, or I was throwing the party and I had all the good stuff and the money, that, you know, people would like me. But the fact is that none of that stuff ever made a bit of difference to me. The only thing that gave me a sense of relief was when I could drink myself into oblivion. That was what I craved, was just something to stop the pounding in my head of the feelings of worthlessness and helplessness and depression and all of that stuff. So things got bad. I ended up flunking out, getting kicked out of college. A semester from graduating, and I caught a charge on campus, and they threw me out. And I got thrown out of my apartment complex subsequently as a result of it, because it was campus-affiliated housing. All as a result of, you know, just not paying attention to what I was doing and drinking too much. So I moved to Tampa, and again, you know, on the kind of steady slope, got a job, mom was helping me out again, I kind of put my life back together, and I think it was probably, I was still doing other things, I was drinking, but moderately, and doing other things as well, but I kind of had everything under control because I was under my mom's house, and pretty soon I'm back to my same old games. I move out, my mom was kind enough to help me get a condo in Tampa, and I moved in there and just completely went off the wall again because I didn't know any other way to live. I was told my entire life that I drank and I used drugs because I was bipolar. But I came to realize that I was bipolar because I drank and used drugs. And when I stopped doing that, everything kind of settled down. So, you know, things got really bad. I ended up going to jail again and stealing from my mom again and just completely betraying the trust of everyone that cared about me at all in pursuit of that next buzz. That's when things really started to go downhill. I went to jail. I violated my probation. I took probation on the charge I caught on campus, and I violated that by not reporting, basically being a screw-up. I wrecked my mom's car on the interstate in Tampa, and basically just flew. I just flew from the scene, fled from the scene. And they came and took the got the information. They luckily didn't arrest me that day because I would have been pretty upset. But they ended up going to jail and coming back out here to Orlando because that's where my charges were. And I did about, what did I do? I think I did 5 months that time. And that was my first experience since I was like 18 years old. I was 23 at the time, 24. And that's my first experience being locked up besides going to juvie. And now it's like, oh, it's the big boys, you know, it's county jail, which little did I know was the just the beginning of my path. And again, I get out and my mom is gracious enough to let me to return to Tampa and give me another chance. And I get out and you don't understand, I'm a changed man, I've seen the light, and I think I spent, you know, I never thought that the problem was alcohol. I said, well, you know what, if I just stay away from the other stuff, I can drink, and I'll drink responsibly, you know. If I just, you know, they say there's a rock at the bottom of every bottle, so I was like, if I just leave all that alone, I'll be fine. Not true. I went right back. I think I was out maybe 4 days this time, and I hid everything. I managed to hide things for, I think, 6 months, and then, you know, it just came out, and it's like, look, violated the probation again, because I'm still on it, after I get out of jail, still on the same term of paper that I got on in, you know, 2004, so this is like 2 years later, and go right back. And it was at this time that I was looking at some time. You know, the courts were like, okay, yeah, you've been here before, we gave you probation, you did some jail time, we let you back out, you violated again, what's going on? I was blessed with the opportunity to go to the Orlando Bridge. I think there might be some guys in here from the bridge. If you guys are here and you're listening, take advantage of the time, that the chance that you got now, because I didn't take it seriously. I did the program 100%. I didn't get a DR the whole time I was there, but I didn't take it seriously. And as a result, I drank when I got out and I went to prison. I'll get to that in a second. I just want to talk about my spirituality for a second. I grew up, I'm Jewish. My parents are both Jews. And but I was raised atheist. My parents pretty much flat out told me God doesn't exist. And that was the ideal that I grew up with. God is not real. And when I did start to think he was real, I was like, well, he certainly doesn't care about me. So I grew up in a very, very anti-God environment, and to the point where I was antagonistic about it. When I got my second violation, I went into jail, and I actually had my first physical or spiritual experience. And I think, like Bill, you know, I had my spiritual experience, but I drank again. I was sitting in 33rd Street, and I was DTing real bad. I don't think I had slept in like 3 days, and all I wanted in the world was just 15 minutes of sleep. Just please, just let me get 15 minutes of solid, uninterrupted rest. And I said, I'm tired of living this way, and I decided that I was going to try believing in God for a change. That I was going to try giving, you know, try this higher power thing that everybody keeps talking about. And I just said a little prayer to myself, and it was, I'm not going to get too much into the spirituality or the specifics of it, but I fell asleep 5 minutes later, and I slept for 6 hours. And when I woke up, I was like, that was kind of weird. What does it mean? And just a chain of events after that led me to believe that there's a bigger plan here than I see. Because instead of going to prison, I got sent to the bridge when I should have probably gone to prison for at least, I mean, the charge carried 15. They were asking for 6. So I got lucky with a new term of paper, 6 months at the bridge, followed by 12 more months of paper. And I went to the bridge, and I did it. And I did it with flying colors. No problems there. I did all my homework. I went to, you know, work every day, deviated a little bit. I'm sure you guys know a little bit about that. You know, maybe the library here and there. But I did it to the T, but I had a reservation, and that reservation was still that I could drink, you know. It's okay if I drink, because that's legal, and they can't put me in jail for just getting drunk. Well, you'd be surprised. So I got out and I drank. And you know, I highly suggest if you've got some reservations and you're in treatment right now, just to take an honest look about why you're there. So I drank, and I did moderately well when I got out. I had a great job. I was making $70,000 a year, and completely just blew it all on booze. I mean, I was $70,000 a year, and between my other activities and alcohol and paying my rent, I was like maybe $20 at the end of the week. I hurt a lot of people that year. That was the year before I went to prison, 2008. I was given a lot of opportunities by a lot of my friends, and all they asked me to do was, don't drink hard, please, just take care of yourself. That's all we want for you, is just stay sober. And I couldn't do it. I got thrown out of numerous places to live because I people were just like, here, you can come stay, don't pay anything. Some people were saying, pay, but just don't drink. And I couldn't do it. I could not do it. And at this point, my parents were pretty much fed up. They, you know, I'd run them through the ringer for the last 15 years, and they were sick of it. So when I went to jail again, and I called, I did the old, you know, 33rd Street, Mom, Dad, I'm in jail, can I have some money? It wasn't there. Letters didn't come. Phone calls were accepted, but the it was time for me to do this on my own. And again, I go in front of the judge, and the judge looks at me, and They give me a choice. They're like, well, you can sit in jail, and you can try and fight this this violation, because really all they had me on was not reporting. Or you can take this time, and you can go and finish it out and be done with it. And I took the time, because I was sitting in the courtroom, and it's still, even at that point, I wasn't done. That's why my sobriety date is not the day before I go to prison. It's the day I got out of prison, because it's not until that day that I was done, but I'll get there. So I took the time, and I went up the road, and, you know, I'm sure there's some people here who've been to prison. I'm sure I'm not the only one. It was a different experience for me. I didn't get messed with. Nobody gave me a hard time. I got in a couple fights. No big deal. I did not like the constant watching my back, and I saw how those guys who had lived that had been there for 30 and 40 years, because they were in my dorm, and I did not want to live like my life like that. That's where the realization came. Is that I did not want to be one of those guys who 30, 40 years later, I mean, you know, you spend 30, 40 years behind bars, your family forgets about you. Your loved ones, they will drift away. And I saw that. I saw people whose mothers wouldn't write to them anymore. And I did not want that to happen to me. And I knew that if I got out, and they told me, they said, if you get out, because they were repeat offenders, and they said, if you get out and you drink or you do drugs, you will come back. That, for me, has been the truth all my life, because I did not stay sober not one time for any considerable amount of time, and I went back every single time. So I got out of prison, and I had all these grandly laid plans, the best laid plans, that I was going to go to program, and I was going to get a job, and all this wonderful stuff, and they were going to take me, and I got out of prison, and nothing went the way it was supposed to go. My mom, you know, picked me up, and I had no place to go. Luckily, I had some money that I had saved from before I went to prison for my last paycheck for my job, because the one thing I did do through all this was I always went to work. And that was the money that I had. And my mom dropped me off here in Orlando, and I checked into the hotel. I forget which motel it is. It's on OBT, so that should say enough. And I checked in there, and this was about 6 o'clock at night. And I had, you know, a small amount of possessions, some clothes, some hygiene articles, and the stuff that I brought with me from prison. And I checked in, and I laid down on my bed, and I did not know what to do. I was out. I was free for the first time in what felt like the longest time in my life. Actually, yeah, that was the longest consecutive time without being free in my life. And I did not know what to do. I was lost. I didn't have any. I had called friends. I had no friends that wanted to talk to me. My parents were not going to help me. I had nothing. I didn't have a friend in the world. And I woke up the next day, and I said, actually, I should mention this. I walked out to the store to go get a pack of smokes from the store. And the guy, there's a guy, you know, it's OBT, so there's guys hanging out everywhere. And the guy sees my slides, and it's very noticeable because they're prison slides. So if you've been there, you know them. And he's like, I know where you just came from. You going to get yourself a beer? And I'm like, no, I'm going to go get some cigarettes. And that was probably the best decision that I made in the first 24 hours. The second best decision was coming here the next day. I woke up the next morning, and I knew I was going back. I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to my old job, and I'm going to try and get them to rehire me so I can make the good money and, you know, just get back into that. I got enough money to kind of last me, and I'll just, you know, kind of trust God and whatever that means to get me through it. And I said, well, I can't do it today. You know, I called them, and they're like, well, come up, blah, 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 come down this week. And I said, well, I do not want to sit in this hotel room by myself. This sucks. And I said, I had been to Central a couple of times before. I was one of those guys that sat on the back row, not knocking you guys, but we'd sit in the back row when we were in treatment, and we would laugh because I would say, oh, I'm not one of those guys. Look, oh, he's crying. Look at him. Oh, he's a wuss. You know, I was that guy. I totally mocked everybody in here. And nobody knew because I sat in the back, and I never said anything. I was in treatment, and I didn't care. But I knew that this was a place that I could come where if I honestly wanted it, people would give me help. And that's what I did. I came here June 17th. I got out of prison June 16th, but I came here June 17th last year. And I raised my hand and I introduced myself, and they said, is anybody attending their first AA meeting ever? And I raised my hand because truthfully that was my first AA meeting. I had maybe been in a room before that was an AA meeting was going on, but I wasn't there. I wasn't there for the AA meeting. I was there to appease the courts or whatever. My counselor, my mom, you know, I wasn't there for myself. But I came here and I raised my hand and I said, my name's Hart and I'm an alcoholic and I don't know what to do and I need help. And, you know, I have been shown an overwhelming amount of love today by my friends that have known me the last 12 months. But the funny thing is they don't treat me any different today than they treated me that day. That was the great thing about this program is that they didn't know me, but they loved me because they heard my story in them, like Marty, wherever you went to. I decided at that point, you know, whatever. I got nothing better to do. I might as well give this thing a try. It seems to be working for you guys. You seem to be happy. You drive nice cars, so I certainly want that. And I did it. And I poked around a little bit. I said hi. I introduced myself. I was personable. I asked people what their name was. I held the door every chance I got for the first, you know, until I got my job. I was on that door every single meeting saying hello to everybody. And that's how people got to know me. I just want to talk a little bit about how I met my sponsor, and then I'm going to try and speed this up a little bit. A guy came up to me, and I think he was kind of coerced by maybe other forces. But, you know, he introduced himself, and it was after an 8 o'clock meeting on a weeknight. And I'm still staying down at the trail. This is like maybe 4 days sober at this time. And I'd say, hey, man, can you give me a ride to the bus stop? And so it's 9 o'clock at night, and I'm not even thinking that, you know, the buses are done running down that side of town. But by the time we get there, which was 10:40. So I'm there for, like, he drops me off, and we have a little talk. You know, he's just asking, you know, typical new guy routine. What's your name? Why are you here? Blah, blah, blah. And he dropped me off, and it starts pouring rain. And I'm sitting there for 40 minutes, and no bus comes. So I call this guy back, and it's 40 minutes later. It's like 11 o'clock at night. He's got to be up tomorrow morning, the next morning to be at work at 5 a.m. And I call him, and I'm like, man, look, the buses stop running. It's pouring rain, and I'm staying on the complete ass end or other end of town. And he came back, and he got me, and he took me all the way down the trail, almost down to Sand Lake Boulevard, and dropped me off in my room. And after talking to him on that ride there, I asked him some questions, and I realized this guy has something that I want. I don't know what it is, but it's something that I want. And that's who I wanted to be my sponsor, because he had something that I want. I couldn't exactly define it. He had a nice, you know, nice truck, and I'm all about the car, so. But it was something else. And so I asked him to sponsor me, and he said, okay. And the first thing I said is, when can I start dating? It's a good thing I didn't. So I got a sponsor, and I was truly, honestly willing to work the steps. And I did them to the best of my ability, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit. Step one, I didn't have a problem with step one. Admitted, one, two, and three, Angel says it all the time. It's pretty easy for me. I was powerless over alcohol. I can't do this anymore. I think somebody else can. I think I'll ask him. I think I'll let him. And that was one, two, and three for me. Just a little bit more in depth. The unmanageability in my life, the number of times that I said I wasn't going to drink and continue to do it, the number of people that I hurt, the number of times I went to jail and treatment over... Anyway, so step one was pretty easy. Step two, 2 years ago, prior to this date, I wouldn't have been able to do, because at that time I did not have a conception of a higher power. I'm blessed that when I came into this room and was ready to work this program, I was able to not have that problem. And my suggestion is just that if you're stumbling at all with step two, is don't worry right now. Take some suggestions, do what's asked, and you'll be contacted. I didn't have that problem. I was I had a pretty firm belief. Step three was a hard one, though. To completely trust something that I don't understand to take me through life with everything. I described it one time as being led down a dark corridor lined with bear traps by somebody that you don't really know or trust. And that's what it feels like, you know, when you lose the job, or when you're homeless, or God's threatening to take away things that are material possessions of yours, and you're going to be uncomfortable, to trust, just to blindly trust him to know what's best, or it, whatever you want to call it, to know what's best for you, and to give it up and let that higher power take control, is the hardest thing that I've had to do on a daily basis. But I do it, and it's worked out. I didn't get the job back at my old place. In fact, I make a lot less money now than I did before I went to prison. But I've trusted God the more or less the whole way. There's been some times when I've taken my will back, but it's always worked out when I stay out of my own way. When I get in my way, bad things happen, and I'll get to that in a moment. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory. That was a tough one. It's a hard step. It can be scary. It wasn't hard to write it all down. That part was easy. But when I talked about it with somebody and I confessed it to God in step five and to another human being, I felt really bad because I did a lot of bad things. But my sponsor looked at me and he told me some of the things that he did, and I was like, okay, I don't feel so bad anymore. Step six was a big one for us. Step six and seven are, he kind of drilled that into my head, defects, you know, and being willing to have God remove those defects of character. I was like, defects of character, okay, I'm a little greedy sometimes, you know. I was like, I don't have any defects. No, I honestly took a look at some of the things, and it's a process. It's not something that I was able to, like, I worked step six, and then I worked step seven, and all my defects were gone. No, I had to concentrate on one a day until it was manageable, and then move on to the next one. And when I got that defect to a manageable point with God's help, I moved on to the next one. And I'm still got quite a few defects to go, but I'm getting there. And that's what it's about, it's progress. Step eight, obviously a very scary one. It's not step eight, it's nine, but eight... making a list of all the persons I had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I hurt a lot of people, particularly my parents. And it was suggested to me that I wait a little while because my parents had heard the song and dance before. You know, I'm sorry, Mom. I'm sorry, Dad. Look, I've been sober 3 months, you know. Give me a break. So it was advised to wait. But I did start making some of the amends, and there's still amends out there to be made. But I was willing to do whatever it takes. Whenever I came, I was confronted with a person that I needed to make amends to, I was willing to go to whatever length they wanted me to make amends, because I wanted to be able to look that person in the eye with a clear conscience and know that even if they reject me, even if they say, get out of my office, like it says in the book, I know that I've done my part, because it's not in the outcome, it's in my action. And if my actions are right, the outcome's not my responsibility. Step 10, I continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I admit it, sometimes promptly. Sometimes it takes me a few days. Usually the pain has to, you know, weigh on me until it's a point that it's like, all right, I need to go ahead and apologize to this person. But for me, step 10 is about, you know, making sure that my house is continually in order. Making sure that I'm looking at my resentments and looking at them honestly. Because people piss me off. I'm sorry. They do. But I have to realize, what is my part in that? Why am I pissed off at this person? And maybe I should look at it as, how can I help them? And that's hard to do. It's hard for me to do on a daily basis. But when it is hard, I ask God to help me. I ask God to save me from being angry and to show me how I can be helpful to this person. And that's how that's what I do to keep my inventory in check. 11 is a hard one, and continue to improve our conscious contact with God, or whatever. It's through prayer and meditation. Prayer is an easy one, because I was talking to God. I was always talking to God. God, help me with this. Please, give me a place to live. Foxhole prayers, the whole nine yards. Meditation, learning to listen, learning to hear what God is telling me. And God doesn't speak to me in voices. Not at least since I was on everything, all the substances. But it's a subtle nudge. The way I used to, my meditation style has changed. I used to meditate on the bus. I would stick my headphones in and look out the window, and I would meditate. And that's changed. I meditate in the shower. You know, I meditate whenever I can. I meditate at work sometimes when I'm sitting waiting for a phone call. What the key is that I'm able to listen and I'm able to hear where my thinking is messed up. And sometimes I have to rely on God to speak through others, particularly my sponsor and my friends, because you guys have been extremely well at pointing out my defects in thinking. It's something that it took practice, but it's something that once it's done, it's allowed me to really feel the nearness of my Creator. But not nearly as much as step 12, which has been profoundly impactful. And that's having had a spiritual awakening. I attempted to carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer and to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I try and practice them in most of them, at least as many of them as I can possibly fit in a day. I had a spiritual awakening, and I just want to touch on that real quickly. I had the spiritual experience where I was willing to, you know, consider believing in a power greater than myself, which was unfathomable for 25 years of my life. But I had a spiritual experience riding the bus one day, and it's going to sound cheesy to some of you guys, but I was riding the bus, and I was at right between steps 8 and 9, and I was looking at some of my friends who had 11, 12, 13 months, a year, 2 years, and I remember saying to myself, how the fuck am I going to stay sober that long? That is impossible. And I was probably 45, 50 days sober at the time, and I said, And it occurred to me, I don't have to. All I have to do, it was 4 o'clock, all I have to do is make it through till midnight. And that's it. That's all I have to do today. And that was just, it sounds silly, one day at a time. That's all we're going to do, one day at a time. But that's all it is. That's all I have to do is, it's 8:45, I've got 3 hours and 15 minutes more to go, and I can call it a wrap. You know, I know that I stayed sober today, didn't drink, didn't put anything else in my body. And that's a success. I have a little few other things I try to do on a daily basis, which is to not hurt anybody and to try and help somebody. And if I can do those 3 things in a day, not drink, help somebody, and don't hurt anybody, then that's a successful day, no matter what happens. I got into sponsorship pretty early, and it's not talked about in the first, you know, 164 pages, but the fact that somebody's looking to me for spiritual guidance is a miracle in and of itself, because that anybody would ask me, what do I do? I mean, seriously? But they do, and I'm able to look at them, and I'm able to tell, and I listen to what I'm saying. I'm like, that makes sense. And then I have to turn around and do it myself, which is the horrible part of it. There's nothing better than telling a sponsee, do this, and then looking at yourself and going, oh, shit, I got to do that too. But it's been the greatest joy to be able to work with some men in here and to do for them what my sponsor did for me, which was show me how to live. Things are different today. I have a job. I have friends. I have family. I'm in contact with most of them. Not in contact with all my family. I've still got some amends to make. But my life is profoundly different today. I can ask my friends for anything, and they'll help me. And they didn't know me from Adam when I walked in here. I'm honest. I don't lie today as much as I did. Just a little honesty. I don't have to worry about where I'm going to get my next drink or my next fix from. I don't wake up dope sick. I don't wake up hungover. I'm respected at my job. They're not always worrying about what's Hart going to do today and what kind of mess is he going to make. I fulfill my obligations, except when, you know, things absolutely cannot be fulfilled. I have integrity today, and until at least more integrity than I had. I know I'm not the most stand-up guy at times. Those are things that I can be proud of, but the most profound thing that has happened to me since I've worked the steps and I came to this program is that I don't hate myself anymore, and I don't want to die, and I don't need to drink to not feel that way. And that's what this program has given me. It's a way of life, and it makes things a lot easier. I don't have as many messes to clean up. I don't offend as many people, but I don't hate myself, and I don't want to die every time that I wake up. I don't go to sleep hoping that it's going to be my last breath. And that is what you guys have shown me how to do. I've taken a little bit from everybody. You know, I had a sponsor. My sponsor took me through the steps, and he showed me how to do this thing. But I took a little something from everyone. And, you know, I may be able to stand up here and say, you know, all these things, but I've made my share of mistakes in sobriety as well. But the fact is, and I've had my share of hard times. I've had my share of, you know, not having money, looking at, you know, not having a job, not having a place to live. But never once since I came here have I gone a day without a roof over my head, without food in my mouth, without a place that I can go where I know the hand that there's a hand that's willing to reach out to me. And that, for me, is just the most beautiful thing about this way of life, is that, you know, I don't know you. If you're in treatment, if you're homeless, I don't know who you are, but I love you. I do, because I was there, and I know what it's like, and if there's anything that I can do to help you, I will. Because that's what was done for me. You guys, you know, I heard a friend of mine say that they loved him loved him until he was capable of loving himself, and that's what you guys did for me, is you showed me so much love that I couldn't help but love myself. Because I figured, you know, shit, if you guys are driving all those nice cars, you gotta be right about something. I'm getting kind of towards the end here, so I just want to pull this out, because I didn't bring my own, because I'm bad about bringing big books with me. But I'm usually good about knowing where stuff's at in them. I did read it. I read the first 164. It was pointed out to me, though, that there is stuff after 164. I've been meaning to take a look at that. For those of you who don't know, this is our big book. Most of you guys know. This is where the solution is. This book was written about me by a guy who didn't know me. And there's some really beautiful parts in it. But I just want to kind of finish up with this thing. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks. Yeah.